This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's John Dalby Banks Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see johncast.net.
Our first question comes from Graton Mack, who says, comets reach their maximum outgassing rate in the vicinity of the Sun. They will condense on the first cold place they find, the ice deposits of Mercury's poles. Would a mission to drill cores into those and investigate the deposits reveal the comet history of the solar system, saving decade-long and vast expense on random trips to the Oort cloud?
That's an interesting idea. But we don't really have to go to the outer reaches of the solar system to investigate these distant objects. We can wait for them to come to us. The Giotto and Deep Impact probes have both visited comets over the last few years. The Stardust mission has actually brought some comet dust to Earth. And the Rosetta mission is currently en route to land on one next May. We get a much better idea of comets in their existing state by visiting them, rather than just investigating their splattered remains that are strewn across the inner solar system. But back to Mercury. Now, we have discovered in the last few months that water ice does actually exist in the deep craters that are permanently shaded from the sunlight and Mercury's poles. That's come from MESSENGER spacecraft, but it's also been found on the poles of the Moon. But where does this ice come from? Well, it probably doesn't come down from a rain of comet tails. The typical comet that passes through the inner solar system is a few tens of billions of tons, and it loses up to a billion tons as it passes the Sun each time. Now, a billion tons might sound a lot, but only a small fraction of that is water ice. Most of it is in other volatiles like carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, ammonia, methane, dust particles, etc. And it's so bright because those particles are very reflective. They're vaporized and they're spread out over a huge area. It's hard to find accurate values, but estimates suggest that as little as 20 to 40 tons of ice is present in the comet's tail. Now, of that, only a tiny, tiny portion is going to hit the poles of Mercury. Most comets don't actually come within the orbit of Mercury, and most that do don't survive. So their evaporated ice is blown out rather than settling on the planet. And Mercury is still only a small dot in space compared to the scale of the inner solar system. Even if water hits the planet, only those molecules lucky enough to fall into a polar crater would survive. And in any case, water ice should be split into hydrogen and oxygen ions by the solar UV radiation long before it settles on the planet. So a gentle rain of comet snow onto Mercury's poles looks relatively unlikely. But that ice, we know, exists, so it has to come from somewhere. Now, there's two main possibilities, and there hasn't really been enough research to tell which one's right. The first is that Mercury started off with that ice, and it seeped out its hot core to the surface. While that's possible, our current understanding of Mercury's history probably makes that less likely. The second possibility is that Mercury captured that ice from somewhere, and the best possible somewhere happens to be comets. But we're not talking about comet tails gently raining snow down onto the planet, but actual comets smashing physically onto the planet. So we could go to Mercury, drill a core into the crater ice and examine its contents. But that might not tell us very much. A lot of the interesting information would be lost in the violence of the impact, such as where the comet came from, how big it was, what its structure was, and so on. Even information like when the impact occurred might be impossible to find out. At the moment, we don't even know if the ice was collected in the last 1 million years or the last 4 billion years. So for the moment, we're better off just going chasing the comets themselves.
Keeping on the small bodies in the solar system theme, Pat O'Grady says, the asteroid belt is often shown as a dense area of asteroids that you would have to carefully navigate your way through. But I've heard that it is in fact very sparse. There are asteroids, but none that are close to each other. Which of any of these is correct?
Ah, the Hollywood bonanza. Our intrepid hero effortlessly pilots his spacecraft through a minefield of tumbling rocks in an effort to evade the baddies, who eventually crash onto an asteroid with a massive and physically improbable explosion. But what's the actual asteroid belt look like? Well, first I'll give you a couple of clues. We've sent the Pioneer, Voyager, Galileo, Cassini, and New Horizons probes straight through it, and it hasn't done them any harm. Secondly, we can see through it. You don't look out from Earth and see a sparkly ring of asteroids in the night sky, so there can't be that many of them out there. Now, the mass of the asteroid belt is only about 4% of the mass of the Moon, a 2/1000th of the mass of the Earth, and it's stretched out into a belt that's 2.5 billion kilometres long. If you could compress the whole lot down to a ring, it would be about a kilometre thick. But the real ring is 180 million kilometres wide and 140 million kilometres deep. 63 million billion cubic kilometres is an awful lot of space. And even though 4% of a lunar mass is not something you want to get hit by, that only works out about 50 milligrams per cubic meter. So if we assume all asteroids are made of Earth-like rock, and you could magically transport yourself to somewhere in the asteroid belt, there's only about a 1 in 40 million chance that you would end up inside an asteroid. The reality is that most of the asteroid belt, like other parts of space, is quite barren. But that's not to say it's not dangerous. The asteroids out there move at tens of thousands of miles an hour relative to each other. That's many times faster than a speeding bullet, so you can imagine the damage that you'd get being hit by even a small one. So much for lazy tumbling rocks, it's more like a cosmic shooting gallery. So that's the bottom line, speed kills. And it's the speed of the asteroids rather than the number which is the main danger to any unprotected body in the solar system. It's also the reason why it's hard to find asteroids that are dangerous to Earth. The smallest ones are most common. Something the size of a large tower block could easily lay waste to a small country. The asteroid that hit Russia recently was only about 17 meters across, and it's about the biggest thing that won't cause damage to whatever it hits on Earth. So watch the skies, or give some astronomers a grant to do it for you.
Our final question comes from Andrew McKenzie, who asks, if a black hole sucks things into its center, what does a white hole do? The opposite?
Well, what is a white hole? It might be nothing but the ramblings of too many science fiction authors. No one knows if they're real or not, and they don't really form a major part of any scientific theories. But what if? What if they're real? Well, the basic premise of a white hole is that it's the opposite of a black hole. Material falling into a black hole ends up spat out of a white hole. But the problem is that that would go against the force of gravity, so we'd have to find some kind of negative gravity pushing things away from it. Then there's the matter of time dilation. You can never see something cross the event horizon, because the light carrying the information to you has used up all its energy trying to escape the black hole. To an outside observer, matter falling into a black hole appears to slow down as it approaches the event horizon and never quite reaches it. If the inconvenience of the laws of physics weren't to stop us, though, we might theoretically see time inside the black hole run backwards. Thus, matter belched out of the white hole might have gone back in time. It would have to be stripped of all its information, otherwise it would violate the principle of causality. So, ignoring minor difficulties like breaking causality and gravity, if a white hole were to exist, it would spew matter devoid of any information out into the past. Now, there's only one place that we know of matter or energy seemingly being instantaneously born into existence, and that's the Big Bang. So, if you're prepared to put up with a little conjecture here, one of two things could be happening. Matter could just be going around and around in space and time, endlessly cycled through black holes and Big Bangs. Or every time matter falls into a black hole, gets spewed out in some other universe's Big Bang. However, that's more science fiction than science fact, so I think we'd better stop there before we escape the bounds of reality entirely.
In that case, thank you for answering our questions, Ian.
You're welcome.
I'd like to thank you to Great Old Mac, Pat O'Grady, and Andrew McKenzie for their questions.